Hello and welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop, a Journal Club podcast series brought to you by the Endocrine Society. I'm your host, Chase Hendrickson, and would like to thank you for joining us for our second episode. We have another good article to review today and a great team with which to review it. And as is the case all the time with this podcast series, we want to make sure that we are taking a close, in-depth look at every article that we review. So as we go through the article, we'll review all of the authors' key points and the conclusions that they come up with, but we'll be giving you our own insight as well. And we're going to take a close look at methodology, in particular at the inferential method, so which study design was used, and then also closely at the results and the discussion to determine if this is something that should change the clinical care that we provide to our patients. And this episode of Endocrine Feedback Loop, like every month, we'll have three endocrinologists discussing an article recently published in one of the society's clinical journals. And as usual, I'm your host and I'm a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Our regular contributor and expert educator today is Imali Sirasena. Imali is a general endocrinologist at Temple University in Philadelphia, and she is also the associate program director for their fellowship. And today, our guest expert is Brad Anawalt from Seattle. He is the chief of medicine at the University of Washington Medical Center and also a vice chair for the Department of Medicine there. And importantly for our discussion today, as you will see, he is a well-recognized expert in hypogonadism and androgen abuse. And as an example, just last year published an article detailing his clinical approach to individuals with androgen abuse. And I want to thank them both for joining us today and on all the preparation that they did for this. And as usual, everything that we discuss will be our opinions only and will not necessarily reflect the opinions of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. This month, the article we are looking at is entitled Rate and Extent of Recovery from Reproductive and Cardiac Dysfunction Due to Androgen Abuse in Men. This is out of the Concord Hospital at the University of Sydney in Australia. And this article was published in the June 2020 print edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. And Nandini Shankara Narayana is the first author. And to start us off, Imali is going to walk us through the introduction and highlight some of the key points there. And Imali, I will let you take it away.
Great. Well, thank you, Chase, for the introduction. And thank you to the Endocrine Society for including me in this podcast series. So when I do journal club at my home institution at Temple, I usually start off by saying why I chose the article I did. You know, why did I gravitate to this article? While androgen abuse may not be a common problem that a lot of endocrinologists see, but I think when we do see it, it can be difficult to manage, and it's very distinct from other conditions that we commonly see in our field. So hopefully by choosing this article, it will help clinicians who may be struggling with these encounters and help them advise their patients. So first off, we could define androgen abuse. So how do we define it? Well, androgen abuse is defined as using androgens without a prescription or medical indication. And the authors of this study report that it's common. They say, they quote, estimating a lifetime prevalence of about 6.4% among young men. But keep in mind that that's in certain populations. So it's usually taken from meta-analysis that include athletes or prisoners. So it may be a bit of an overestimate of what you may see in a general population. And as a bit of a historical overview, this is not a new problem. It's been reported as far back as the 1950s, where it started in power sports and then progressed more to community use in the 1980s. So what are the risks of androgen abuse? There are several risks to the person abusing androgens, and these can include effects on fertility due to suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis and effects on spermatogenesis. There's also concerns about effects of cardiotoxicity due to androgen abuse. And a lot of questions remain regarding how severe the effects are and whether they're reversible when people stop abusing androgens. As endocrinologists, we may see these patients in a variety of situations. We may have patients that are surreptitiously abusing androgens. They may have a history of androgen abuse and then stopped and looking for us to guidance on working through that transition. Or they may have a history of abuse and are hoping to get medically prescribed testosterone from us. So these encounters can often be difficult for the patient and they can be difficult for the provider. So I wanted to ask Brad what his experience has been with dealing with patients with androgen abuse and what are the biggest challenges we face in seeing them.
Amali, I'm so glad you asked that question. These men that use anabolic androgenic steroids are a particular challenge in the clinic. They come in and they're somewhat suspicious of the medical profession. They're taking a compound that is illegal. They're doing it for a variety of reasons, some of which include to enhance their appearance, to increase their strength. They don't want to stop these drugs often, and they know a lot about them. They don't put a lot of credence into our assessment as medical professionals that they might be dangerous. So with that backdrop, we have to work really hard to establish a trusting relationship. And if you come across as moralistic or judgmental, they'll simply disappear and never return. So one of the biggest challenges I have is how to establish that trusting relationship and then figure out how to perform ethical medical care that I feel comfortable with, but that does not result in them disappearing into the ether and never coming back to me for my advice. So sometimes I do things that I don't conventionally do in medical practice in the spirit of trying to practice the safest medical care for these men. And we can go into a little bit of detail later about what that means.
So Amali outlined for us a few different scenarios, and I'm sure there are other scenarios as well, but do you have a sense of the most common situation that these men are coming to you in? You think they're taking androgens and they're not telling you that, or they're upfront about it and they want off of them and they want done with everything, or they're trying to transition from abuse to prescribed. Do you have a sense of what's the most common scenario that you encounter?
The two scenarios that I see most commonly are men that are using androgenic anabolic steroids and are coming in asking for an additional prescription, oftentimes because their supplies become unreliable or for a variety of other reasons. The other scenario is directly relevant to the study that we're about to review, and that is that men who are seeking fertility, oftentimes in their early to mid-30s or sometimes in their 40s, will stop using androgenic anabolic steroids in the context of trying to get pregnant with a spouse, significant other. And in that setting, they're coming in asking for assistance either to stop the steroids or to enhance their fertility. And that's relevant to this paper because we're going to be looking at a group of men where you're going to ask the question, what was their motivation for stopping steroids?
Exactly. I think the latter scenario is something I have encountered, and I think quite a few endocrinologists have encountered as well. So the need for this study, I think, is that it is important to try to get some data on the long-term effects of androgen abuse and the degree to which they can be reversed so that we can help counsel and guide our patients. The definition of the fact that it is illicit abuse means there's not a lot of great research out there. And so sometimes that can limit our ability to talk to our patients and give them advice.
So Brad, can you give us just an overview from your perspective? So how limiting is this lack of information that we have? And I think that's going to inform why we need studies like this. But what questions do you find yourself repeatedly asking yourself when you're seeing these patients that you feel like the medical literature in its current state can't answer, or at least can't answer very well?
Well, you asked two big questions there in a single breath, Chase. The first question is, how does the dearth of information about the health consequences and sequela of using these anabolic androgenic steroids long-term affect my ability to counsel patients? And it's a great difficulty. Part of the difficulty about anabolic androgenic steroids is they're shrouded in myth. And there are many in the general public and in the medical care profession that view these as immoral and that they're going to cause all sorts of severe adverse health consequences. There are others that, particularly in the general public, that haven't seen any proven harm. And so in that setting, having inadequate amount of information is really, really problematic because it means that I can't look the patient in the eye and say, here are the list of proven adverse effects. I can tell them about the effects on the reproductive axis because we have a sound basis for saying that taking these compounds
will adversely affect reproductive function, specifically fertility, and may do so for a protracted period of time, as illustrated by this study. So that makes it a very difficult quandary. The second question you had was how to approach this in the absence of good information. And I think one of the important elements of this is to avoid the moralistic overtones that often accompany this particular topic. Come at it from the perspective of a caring healthcare professional who's not there to wag my finger, but to do the best thing possible for the overall health. And in that setting, I do reemphasize the adverse effects on the reproductive axis. And then I emphasize that one of the most important areas of which there's uncertainty is the possibility that it may cause adverse effects on the cardiovascular system. And so translating that into plain English, I tell them it may cause strokes and heart attacks. And one of the things that's very compelling for these younger men is to talk about the possibility that it may cause atherosclerosis of all blood vessels, including the blood vessels to the penis, and may ultimately cause erectile dysfunction. Now, I don't say this with any certainty, but I do indicate to them that they're going into an area where there are concerns about these adverse effects. I will tell you that what often catches their attention is more than strokes and heart attacks, is the long-term sequela on sexual function.
Yeah, I think the big question that this study was trying to get at is, how often does recovery from androgen abuse happen, and what is the timeline? How quickly can we expect that to happen?
And so now what we want to start doing is taking a close look at the methodology. So with that question in mind, how did the authors propose that they go about trying to answer that question? And the first thing that we're going to do is look at the study design. As I mentioned at the very beginning, is something that's going to be important for us to take a close look at. And so this was a cross-sectional study. So we're going to take a step back and just talk about cross-sectional studies in general for a few minutes before we take a close look at this article in particular. So cross-sectional studies, the way that they work is they enroll a population of subjects. This can be subjects that already existed that were collected in a database, or it may be subjects that are newly enrolled for a study. But the key thing that makes it a cross-sectional study is that all of the variables of interest are collected at a single point in time. And then, depending upon what it is that you're looking at, you will take the variables of interest and describe them as either exposures or outcomes. And this is in contrast to other types of studies. So another observational study that would be very different is a cohort study. And in cohort studies, patients are followed over time. So that's not the case in cross-sectional. All the data, whether it's lab, whether it's history, imaging, whatever it is that you're doing, is collected at a single point in time. And the way I like to think about these different study designs, particularly as somebody who is reading an article, is what are the pros? So why would somebody use a study design like this? And then what are the cons? What are the things as a reader that I need to be taking a look at with a close eye? So the pros of a cross-sectional study design make sense. They are relatively fast because there is no time component. For the same reason, they tend to be relatively inexpensive because you don't have to follow patients over time. You don't have any loss to follow up. You have a complete data set. And if it's a population-based cross-sectional study, then you can actually get a prevalence. So an example of this would be an NHANES study in the United States. It's a very well-known cross-sectional study, and that can provide prevalence for many diseases of interest. But the cons of this study design, and these are cons that are essentially intrinsic to this study design, is that it can be very challenging to determine the cause and the effect. To give you an example, just an example that's used very commonly to illustrate this, if you were doing a cross-sectional study trying to look at the relationship between, say, obesity and watching television, it can be difficult to know which is your exposure and which is your outcome. Is the exposure that individuals watch many hours of television and that increases the risk for obesity, or is actually obesity the exposure and because of obesity, that's why these individuals might watch television more? So that just illustrates that it can be difficult to know which is the cause and which is the effect in these types of studies. Because there is no time component, there's often limited information about natural history and prognosis of conditions that you would have an interest in. as is the case for any type of observational study, confounding has to be a concern. We will look here at, towards the end of the method section about how the authors address confounding. We'll talk a little bit more at that time about what confounding is. And I think a couple of biases that are important to pay attention to and be aware of here, and these are recall bias and detection bias. Recall bias is related to the subjects in the study. So whenever a subject in the study is aware of whether they have the outcome of interest, that individual may think very differently when asked to recall something in the past. So getting ahead of ourselves, but looking at this study, if an individual who had used androgen in the past and was being asked questions about when and how much and a variety of details about that, if he knew that he had low testosterone, because either he had been told that or based on symptoms, he was fairly certain that that was the case, he may very well remember his exposure differently. And so that could affect unintentionally the information that he is reporting as a part of the study. The flip side of that coin is detection bias, and that's something that investigators can do. So if investigators aren't careful and they know whether the person that they are talking to or examining or interpreting labs has the outcome of interest, they may look for exposure in that individual differently. And so I think as we look through the study, particularly related to recall bias, that will be something that will be important for us to keep in mind. So as we go back to this study in particular, as we mentioned earlier, this is out of Australia, and this was a cross-sectional study. And the exposure here was androgen abuse. And the authors here split the exposure into a couple of subcategories that we'll get to, but it's based on whether they are current users or past users of androgens. And then the unexposed group would be those who have never used androgens. The inclusion criteria here is relatively broad. So it's men between the ages of 18 and 55. And really the only other criteria beyond that is that they had to be regularly involved in recreational exercise. So whenever we look at inclusion criteria, you like relatively limited inclusion criteria. You want this to be as broad as possible of a population to make sure it is generalizable as it can be. And I think it's important here to talk about the recruitment methods that they used because of how challenging it can be to recruit individuals into a study like this. And the authors used a variety of ways to enroll individuals into this study. So social media, there was advertising on. They advertised their needle exchange programs, gyms, a lot of word of mouth advertising as well. And the investigators were very clear up front that with participants that they would not be prescribing drugs, that there would be no payments related to this, and that the study authors would refrain from collecting potentially incriminating evidence in an attempt to encourage open sharing of information. Now, that being said, there's still a lot of challenges related to this. I did think it would be helpful for Brad to give some insight here as to the challenges of doing a study related to androgen abuse and maybe why we have so few of these studies because of that.
Well, you've touched importantly on one of the biggest problems with recruitment of subjects to a study like this. You have a drug that is illegal in many parts of the world and is associated with connotations of immorality in many parts of the world. And so men don't want to sign up for the study where they may feel that they're being judged or criticized. So it's you're already selecting a certain kind of subject that is willing to participate in a study and expose himself. And I do keep saying him and he, because it's almost exclusively men that use anabolic androgenic steroids, very, very uncommonly in women, and only in the athletic world really do you see women chronically abusing anabolic androgenic steroids. So back to the question, it's a special selected group of men that are willing to participate in a study and admit that they either previously used or are currently using. And so you have to wonder what the motivations are for men that participate in these studies. It could be that the men that report that their current users are thinking about quitting in the very near future. And the importance of this is that we're going to attempt to extrapolate the findings of this study to all men that are using anabolic androgenic steroids. And I don't think you can extrapolate from this particular group that's selected and may include men that are very different than men that use anabolic endocrine steroids for 5, 10, 15 years at very, very high dosages. So it's a very important flaw, or not a flaw, but a limitation to the study.
And this is something I think even broader as we think about research in general, medical research, is that the aspect of volunteer bias, and this can be true of any type of study that you do, is that the individuals who tend to volunteer for medical studies are often not representative of the general population. And that's no matter what you're looking at or what the study design is. So even randomized control trials, which we think of as the gold standard type of study, still suffers from volunteer bias, in that the individuals in the study may not very well represent the general population. And Brad, I think you're absolutely right, is that this in particular, because of how they're having to recruit these individuals and all of the associated issues, may be much more of an issue as well. So when they did recruit these individuals and enroll them, they split the individuals, like I said, into two large groups. So whether they had never used androgens or whether they had used androgens. And then the androgen using group was split into two subgroups. One is those individuals who are currently using androgens and those who are past users. And here they chose 3 months as a cutoff. So if you had not used androgens in more than 3 months, then you were a past user of androgens. And when the men came in for this assessment, for the lab assessment, there was a single morning draw, and there were a host of androgens, estrogens that were drawn, lipids, and also an echocardiogram was done. And we'll look at some of the particulars of those and the results. And one question that I had when I was looking at that, another area that we'll ask for Brad to give us some input on, is it a big deal that it's only a single assessment? Because whenever we see individuals clinically just for hypogonadism, it's a pretty big emphasis. There's a lot of day-to-day variability, so you've always got to repeat a lab draw. You rarely make a diagnosis based on a single assessment. So Brad, in this situation, when you're looking at individuals, some of them who've never used androgens, but several who have, does it make a difference that it's only a single draw? Is that a limitation or really not that big a deal here?
So they measured three different parameters on a single time basis. One was the measurement of hormones that you alluded to. And for purposes of the study, I don't think it's a major flaw that they had a single blood sample. What you're looking here is at a group effect as opposed to an individual effect. And it would have been strengthened by them doing more than one sample and taking the average. But when you're looking at groups, I think a single blood test is probably adequate. I'm more interested in the other parameters. So I think it's fine to do a single echocardiogram as your baseline assessment. But the biggest one is doing a single assessment of seminal fluid analysis. There is enormous variation, and we typically look at 3 to 6 seminal fluid analyses in a normal man before we determine what is his average output. And that's important because we do have a so-called normal group here, and I couldn't tell from the methods section whether they did a single sample or not. And importantly, in the group that was described as past and current users, those two groups, some of those men had sperm in their ejaculate, and you have to wonder what was their average number. So that's probably a bigger limitation in the study than the single assessment of hormones.
And what we'll wrap up with here is a word on some of the adjustments that were done. So I mentioned at the very beginning of the methods section that confounding is always an issue that you have to be concerned about in observational studies. And a confounder is an exposure that is related to whatever you have labeled as your exposure. So in this situation, we are in this study, the authors are looking at exposure to androgens. A confounder would be a different exposure that is related to androgen use and is also contributing and maybe the sole contributor to the outcome of interest. Just to make up an example here, one that the authors did account for would be age, is that you would have to wonder, is in a population of men ages 18 to 55, if if age could have an impact on how much androgens were being used, how long they were being used for, some other factor to where it could potentially be age that's making the difference in the measured testosterone levels. And so these are the sorts of things that you would want to account for. And generally speaking, there's two approaches that you can use to account for confounders. One is to simply match, is so to say, for every group that we have, we're going to make sure that they are the same for all these groups. So if we enroll a 25-year-old guy in the exposed group, we're going to also make sure that we have a 25-year-old guy in the unexposed group, so that whatever you're concerned about will be equal in both groups, and so they'll cancel each other out. The other approach, and this is what's used in this study, is adjustment. So you wait until after you have collected all of your data, and then you identify all of these potential confounders, which requires, first of all, that you have thought about them as being a potential confounder, and then second of all, that you have found some way to effectively measure that. And then once you can do that, then you can adjust for those. So you can measure the impact that that confounder is having on your results, and then you can adjust to see if whatever difference you're finding between groups remains even after you have adjusted for that. And the authors here, and there was also a helpful series of letters, a letter to the editor and a response from the authors to where they did a good job in that of clarifying exactly what it was that they adjusted for. And it was age, a variety of anthropomorphic measures, looking at some other physical findings, acne, gynecomastia, temporal hair loss, and then a lot of details about androgen abuse itself, so how long they had abused for, time since they had stopped using, their usage pattern, post-cycle therapy. We'll talk more about those in the results. But all of those were looked for, measured, and used in an adjustment. And so this is a broad overview of the methodology that they used here. And we may come back to some of this as we work through the results and the discussion to see how that may have had an impact.
Moving on to the results. So who were the participants that they recruited for this study, and what characteristics did the study authors look at or not look at? So as Chase mentioned, there were three groups: current users, past users defined as men who had not abused androgens for 3 months, and healthy exercising controls. So they had 41 current users, 31 past users, and 21 healthy non-user controls. And all three groups were similar for age, as Chase alluded to earlier, marital status, sexual orientation, smoking and alcohol intake, height, bone mineral density or content, fat and bone mass. So in this study, most participants were in their early 30s. The authors mentioned that the proportion of non-heterosexuals was higher than expected for the Australian male population. So Australian male population in general, about 3% of the population is non-heterosexual. In their group of patients, they found that was 8%, so high, slightly higher than expected. They noted that the current users had higher weight, BMI, body surface area, lean mass, pulse rate, and blood pressures. And current users also had higher hemoglobin levels, which is not surprising given the known effects of testosterone on red blood cells. They had higher leukocyte counts, higher serum creatinine, and lower serum albumin. So Brad, I wanted to ask you, did you notice any unexpected differences between these groups?
The only finding that struck me as a little peculiar was the lower serum albumin. And I can't explain that from the use of anabolic androgenic steroids. It does highlight something that Chase and you both alluded to, which is that the study populations were using drugs other than anabolic androgenic steroids. And so it makes one wonder if they were this lower albumin might have been related to some hepatotoxin or something else. It could have just been by chance because the study groups were quite small.
And I think whenever we're looking at these tables, and often we'll describe it as your table one in this study, because the authors did actually a very good job of looking at many different parameters. They split it into multiple different tables, but still using that terminology of table one as the initial one that just describes the population overall. It's always helpful to be looking at that and saying, does this look like the patients that I see? When I see these numbers and this description, does that seem to fit with the standard patient that I see, or does this seem to be describing not a typical patient for me? And I think that's helpful as a reader when you look at these articles that say, can I apply this to my patient population? Or maybe are these authors studying a different population than I'm looking at? And I think overall, these numbers certainly fit with all of the standard, I'd say, individual that I would see in this situation.
I agree with that. And I think one of the interesting things to me about this study is just reading the description of the population, because again, as we've alluded to, these are men that may not be in the medical system, and we may not be getting all of the most accurate history. So I thought that that was interesting in just even reading the description of the population. And so what patterns of androgen abuse did they note in this study? So they reported the mean age of first androgen use was 25, with 16% starting under the age of 18. Their median duration of use was about 2.4 years. And again, I think as Brad mentioned earlier, we probably have a lot of patients that are using much longer than that. So that's also something to keep in mind when we look at this population. So 51% of the current users versus 81% of past users reported a cyclical pattern, meaning 12 weeks on androgens, 12 weeks off, the rest used continuously. So Brad, I personally wasn't very familiar with the cyclical versus continuous pattern of androgen abuse. Do you have any thoughts on that or how it may have affected the study?
Men who use anabolic steroids will often do two patterns. One is called stacking, which is to use multiple different compounds. And the other one is to cycle, meaning that they go on, off, or they vary the different androgenic compounds that they're using. And the thinking is that if you use lower doses of multiple compounds, that's stacking, or if you use very high doses and then cycle on to something else or off of anabolic androgenic steroids and take a holiday, that perhaps either one of those interventions or methods of using will reduce the adverse effects. There's no evidence to support that. And I'm not sure for this particular paper that it makes a big difference in trying to interpret the data. It just indicates that there was one difference between the two groups. And because this is all based on memory and that the average length of time off of steroids for the past users was 300 days, it's pretty hard to know how accurate their memory would be.
So about 93% of the current users were using injectable testosterones, and that could be plus or in addition to oral androgens. There was a wide variety of androgens used. So I think Brad just alluded to this point. So, and they were often using them, different androgens at the same time. So testosterone esters, endogenous proandrogens, alkylated androgens, synthetics. And this again was all self-reported, and there was no estimated dose. So we don't know, you know, how much of this people were taking. And, you know, it serves to reason that the dose may affect some of the parameters they were looking at. There was also a wide variety of substances used. So in this paper, they have a table 4 that nicely lists every substance that people reported using. The most common was protein supplements, tamoxifen, amphetamines, and marijuana. There were multiple other illicit hormones that were listed, such as thyroxine, growth hormone, and insulin. And so again, when we talk about confounders, this is, you know, a huge list of confounders, basically, because they're on these multiple other substances. So Brad, what were your thoughts on the, you think you've alluded to this earlier, but the reliability of self-reported androgen use and not being able to quantify the amount of androgen used?
I don't think this is unique to the use of androgens. If you look at studies of dietary patterns, we have a difficult time either remembering or recounting precisely what we took. So I think there is a problem with self-report. There's probably a problem here with self-report of use of other substances that might affect some of the outcomes in this study. So I think it's really very difficult to interpret some aspects of the study because we're relying, as we do with most of these studies, on self-report. It's not possible, for instance, to do a randomized controlled trial of anabolic androgenic steroids at high doses, at least it's not considered ethical.
And Brad, when we were talking about this before, I know you had pointed out that in particular, if you're looking at cardiac function, concern that, yes, we're looking at effects of androgens on that, but if you've got individuals who are taking growth hormone and cocaine, other substances that have known cardiac effects, then you have to be worried that that actually may be driving differences, if you find any differences. And if those aren't accounted for, then that can make it really challenging to figure out what effect androgens are having.
Yeah, Chase, and the current user, 35% were using growth hormone at some point, reported using it within the distant past. 30% were using cocaine. An equal number were using amphetamines. These are all things that affect cardiac parameters, so it does taint the data. The other thing that's a little difficult about interpreting the past and current use is that the authors, at least in this manuscript, didn't discern between when they were using oral versus injectable substances. And as a rule of thumb, the oral androgens have a very short half-life and will wash out quickly, and your body is more likely to recover quickly. Whereas if you use a long-acting androgen, specifically the injectable forms, they may linger in the body for months and cause suppression of the axis based simply on the long half-life. So that could be important in trying to interpret these data as well.
Moving on to discuss basically their table four, which is where they went into reproductive function, and is that different between current users and former users. So they did steroid hormone measurements, which were performed by liquid chromatography mass spec. They report the testosterone levels. They reported them in nanograms per milliliter. I converted it to nanograms per deciliter, since that's what most of us in the U.S. are used to. So the average testosterone level for the current users was 3,650, which is quite high. And I did double check my math when I came up with that result to make sure I didn't do it wrong. But that's it. And it's pretty high. It was 620 nanograms per deciliter for past users, and 870 nanograms per deciliter for non-user controls. So I thought this was interesting in that the level for past users was lower than non-user controls, but still, I think, well in the normal, what most endocrinologists would consider the normal range. So in this study, again, they have three groups: the non-users, which is the control, current users, and past users. And basically, the way I thought of this study is that they're trying to look at the past users and see if the past users look like people that never use steroids, which would be our hope, that they recover and they don't have any long-term effects, or do they have some similarities with the current users? And so basically, the variables that they looked at, they did not see a difference between past users and non-users, meaning the past users looked mostly like men that had never abused anabolic steroids, except with a mild reduction in testis volume and serum SHBG. So I wanted to ask Brad, in your experience, do you think these findings are meaningful clinically?
They are. The importance of the reduced testicular volume was covered by the authors. It suggests that there is a persistent suppressive effect on spermatogenesis or spermatogenic function in the testes of the users and the non-users. And the importance of this is that most of the volume of the testis is seminiferous tubules. So to have a persistent small size indicates that perhaps they haven't been restored fully to normal. The implications of having a low SHBG is that your free, unbound testosterone is going to be disproportionately higher than your total testosterone. So both of those have clinical implications. The effects on free testosterone are probably less relevant to interpreting this study, because the authors did not analyze for recovery of testosterone, because they couldn't. They couldn't look at the men and accurately assess what was going on with their testosterone for a variety of reasons, basically based on the way they recruited the men, and that the users had very, very high testosterone concentration, suggesting current use. I want to ask Chase one question here, because Amala, you pointed out something very interesting, which is if you look at the serum testosterone concentrations, the non-user controls have a mean serum testosterone concentration of 870 nanograms per deciliter. And in most assays, that's right at the top of the upper limit of normal, or maybe even above the upper limit of normal. They don't provide the normal range for serum testosterone in their assay, but that begs the question, are these controls truly normal? And so I wanted to ask Chase about how we look at controls in these kinds of studies that are cohort studies.
Yeah, I think that's another good point, looking at this, and certainly just first of all, kind of looking at that difference between pass and non-users, there was not a statistical difference. It may be because of the spread of the data or because it's relatively small. I think the authors actually in their response to the letter to the editor point out that the residual effects of that low SHBG may be an explanation for the point estimates being a little bit off there. But Brad, I think that's a good point, is that you might have to question, again, when you look at that, one of those first tables, that, hey, is this really representative of the general population? Yeah, 870 maybe isn't. And so it's possible that these healthy controls are maybe healthier than the normal controls that are included when reference ranges are established. Maybe it's an age phenomena, hard to know what. But I think you're right, it does make a good point, is that maybe this is not a great source of comparison. It may be the best that you have, and I think we'll come back to this a lot. I think the authors are doing a good job in a challenging situation to make the best interpretation that they can. But it is such a challenging group and subject to look at that there can be these limitations that are very hard to get around.
Maybe it's a difference with the Australian population. They just have higher testosterone levels than the rest of the world. So, moving on to their other findings. So again, as was discussed earlier, they couldn't look at testosterone levels alone. So they used other markers to look at recovery of reproductive function. So the estimated mean time to recovery for serum LH, luteinizing hormone, was 10.7 months. And for AMH, it was 7.3 months. So anti-Müllerian hormone, which acts as a marker of gonadal function. So again, these were used as surrogate estimates of recovery of endogenous testosterone, given that LH drives testicular testosterone production.
I thought something that was really nice here, and the author's comment that this is something that's only recently been done, is you look here, we said earlier on, a limitation of cross-sectional studies is that you can't give natural history. So these sorts of challenges exist in trying to come up with a number. How many months or days or years does something last for? And so I think the authors, knowing the challenges here and that a cross-sectional study may be the best type of data that you can get here, they use the reported lengths of how long it has been since androgens were used to try to estimate these numbers. And I think that was why they were able to come up with these numbers, when typically a cross-sectional study can't tell you how long something's gone on for, or in this situation, how long it takes to recover. And so I do think that was a nice use to try to estimate. I think Brad's points are excellent, is that recall is extremely challenging. So I think we do have to be very cautious about saying 10.7, that's it. We're really confident that's exactly how long it takes to recover. So I don't think that can be the message that you take here, but I do think it does give us a ballpark, with that caveat of it's based on recollection of how long it's been since androgens were used. And when the authors graph this out, particularly with the relationship of LH, the big driver for LH increasing is simply time. So that relationship between time since last use and luteinizing hormone, the R value, which is a pretty standard way of describing that relationship, was relatively high at 0.76. And so I think that clearly indicates that time is the biggest factor leading to increase in LH.
For testicular steroidogenesis, the authors reported it took about 10 to 14 months for sperm concentrations to normalize, and longer periods were required for sperm motility recovery, so 38 months, and the return of serum inhibin B to the adult male range took about 32 months, and they mentioned inhibin B is a marker of Sertoli function. But for the authors, they reported that sperm output was mostly restored by 14 months. They noted that for sperm variables, the duration of prior androgen abuse was associated with a slower recovery time. post-cycle therapy with HCG or anti-estrogens had no impact on recovery. And they did report that both acne and gynecomastia were present in both current users and past users.
Molly, may I make two comments about these data here? They do report that spermatogenic recovery took about 10 to 14 months. That was an average. If you look carefully at figure one, you'll see that the comparator group, the past users, at least four and perhaps five of the 31 subjects had sperm concentrations or sperm outputs that are quite low. So that suggests that the mean may have actually normalized, but a substantial minority of these men continue to have low sperm outputs. So that's a little problematic. We're being sort of distracted by the average results here and can't broadly extrapolate to all of the subjects. The other comment I would make is that the authors state that post-cycle therapy with HCG or anti-estrogens didn't have any impact on recovery of spermatogenic function. This is important because there's great controversy about whether the administration of an aromatase inhibitor or SERM, both of which will stimulate gonadotropin secretion from the pituitary, or HCG, which is a gonadotropin, either endogenous LH by giving a SERM or an aromatase inhibitor, or exogenous LH, both will stimulate spermatogenesis, or at least raise intratesticular testosterone levels to the point that they may stimulate spermatogenesis. So that's been proposed as a potential treatment for men who are attempting to recover from suppression of anabolic androgenic steroids. And so one of the points behind this is they claim there is no effect, but their study is simply not powered for that. It's a very small number of men in general that they're studying, and about 25% of the men were using one or the other of these therapies. We don't know when. So I think it's problematic for them to make much of a conclusion about this. They might be right. Their study's not designed to prove this, and their data don't clearly establish that.
So moving on, the second major area that these authors were looking at were cardiac function. And again, did cardiac function differ between the groups that they had identified? So they noted that current users had elevated systolic and diastolic blood pressures, increased left ventricular mass, and reduced global longitudinal strain. So they note that this global longitudinal strain is a more sensitive marker of left ventricular function. So ejection fraction was normal in all the groups, but this global longitudinal strain is a more sensitive marker, and so that was reduced in current users. So essentially, all the cardiac outcomes that they looked at were the same between past users and non-users. So this did suggest that men that stopped androgen abuse did not have any prolonged effects on their cardiac function. And this was different from some prior studies, which had shown prolonged effects on cardiac global strain in men who stopped abusing androgens.
And so at this point, what we'll do is we will transition into looking at the author's discussion and a conclusion and give you some of our thoughts on that. So first of all, the authors conclude in sum that androgen abuse by young men using non-prescribed androgens for an average of a little over 2 years does appear to be fully, though slowly, reversible, apart from some of the things that they mentioned already. So the residual reduction in testicular volume and also serum SHBG. And this is largely based on the fact that while groups, when you compare the current users, were different from past and non-users, the past and non-users were not different. And so I think this is certainly helpful. Certainly, there's lots of caveats, and there's just almost no way that you're going to get away from having caveats in a study like this. It is such a challenging thing. And I think certainly the authors are to be applauded for taking on a challenging question, a challenging population to study to try to answer these questions. And so the caveats have to be there. They'll always be there. But I do think it really helps provide some helpful information in this group. And you want to make sure you're applying it to the right group. So relatively young men who have taken androgens for only about 2 years or so. But in that group, while you can see deleterious effects while they're using androgens, those at least largely appear to go away with time, though it may take a while for that to completely happen. And so I'm curious for both Imali and Brad, kind of what were your thoughts on this author's conclusion of their results?
Well, I generally agree with the conclusions that their data and other data suggest that upon cessation of anabolic androgenic steroid use, that you slowly recover function. There appears to be a temporal relationship between the duration of anabolic androgenic steroid use and how long it takes to recover. So I agree with that. The only small point that I would quibble with is the term fully reversible. And as I pointed out, when you look at the sperm data, which is an important outcome, the average age of these men is in their early 30s. They might be interested in attempting to have a family sometime in the not so distant future, because that's close to the average age in many countries of men attempting to have children. So you'd want to have evidence that they've fully recovered to their baseline. We don't know what they had as a baseline in terms of sperm output, but nonetheless, the numbers that we have suggest that they hadn't recovered to the normal range for men with normal reproductive function. So whether that's related to the use of anabolic androgenic steroid use, or whether that just reflects their baseline lower sperm production, we just simply don't know. So I think it would be premature to conclude that there is full recovery based on their data.
I agree. I mean, I think, Chase, what you were talking about earlier, I think what we would want to have is a cohort study, right? We would want to have a group of people that abuse testosterone and then stop and then see what happens to them. And we don't have that here. So they did, I think, the next best thing. And so it sort of appears like they're on a continuum, but they're really not. So we are comparing completely different groups. And as we alluded to earlier, we don't know why the men who stopped androgen abuse, why they did it. So they are clearly not a randomized population. But again, I agree with you. I think with all the limitations of trying to do this kind of study, I really applaud the authors for making the effort. And I think that I agree essentially with their conclusions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Imali, is that certainly you could never do something like a randomized control trial here. That would certainly be unethical in giving somebody a substance at high doses like that, that you would have concerns about deleterious effects. A cohort study could be considered, and that would certainly give you much more concrete information about exactly when androgens were stopped if you had an individual enrolled in a study, and that could be a timestamp, so to speak. But the authors do point out that it would be very challenging to do any other type of study design. And I think given this population, following these individuals for years would certainly be very challenging and may never be feasible. So this truly may be the best study design that would be available. And another conclusion that the authors come up with is really based upon the use of LH. And we've talked about this before, because testosterone is not helpful, because early on when you're using androgens, your testosterone levels are going to be extremely high. And so that's going to make it challenging. Whereas LH might give you a bit more of a spectrum of it starting very low whenever you're actively abusing and then go up over time. And thinking about that, Brad, any thoughts about use of LH primarily for that, limitations there, or just totally necessary for a study like this?
Well, I think they had no other choice than to use LH, which is their surrogate marker for testosterone production. I don't see any way around that. It does highlight, as you were describing, Chase, that the problems are they use a lot of inferential data to try to attempt to establish in this cross-sectional study, whether men, the rate of recovery and whether men have recovered. The other confounder in this study is, and we've gone over this, but it's worth re-emphasizing, is that these men were taking agents that are known to increase LH concentrations and FSH concentrations. And so it begs the question, how fully suppressed were they during the time of use and at the time that they ceased taking the drugs? And of course, we don't know which individuals were taking what. So it could be there was a small fraction of the men that were taking these, or it could be that everybody was taking a little bit of something, and we just won't know.
And Will illustrates in his population, it's not a single agent that they're taking. For some guys, maybe it is, but for many of these guys, it's many, many agents that they're taking, and trying to isolate out the effects of one can be really challenging.
It looks like about almost half of the past users reported using some sort of aromatase inhibitor at some point. So it would certainly beg the question, were some of the past users, did they go back to those at any time? And that would certainly confound the data.
I think the authors do a nice job of highlighting some of the strengths and limitations of their study. So they very accurately point out limitations of it being an observational study by unavoidable nature of that it's a relatively small sample size, though I might say that given the challenges of enrolling a population like this, they certainly did a good job of getting a relatively large amount of individuals in this study. They also point out that a relatively short duration of abuse, so 2.4 years on average, could have limitations, as I know certainly in clinic we can see individuals who have been using abusing androgens for many, many years, and so it certainly is hard to know how applicable data related to only 2.4 years of use would be to somebody who's been abusing androgens for 10 or 20 years potentially. But I think overall, for this, the question that they're trying to answer, given the population that they have, I think it's a good study, provides helpful information here. And I think this is probably going to be the best that we're going to be able to get and can certainly guide our practice. And so that's where I think we want to leave it today, is trying to decide what implications for clinical practice this article has. So based on anything here, will it change your clinical practice? Will it confirm what you're doing? Do you feel like you have more data for how you're approaching these right now? What impact does this have? And particularly the authors conclude that maybe we should be thinking about using AMH and LH or FSH as markers to monitor recovery. And so they suggest that as a possible implication of their study. And so Brad, I'd be curious for your input, and Molly as well, is if this will change how you approach these patients.
This study confirms my previous practice. It's useful in affirming that there is a suppressive effect on reproductive function. I can use this information to counsel, again, in a non-judgmental fashion, the men that report they're using anabolic androgenic steroids. I can also use this information to help guide them about discontinuing such therapy. If they're thinking about a family in the future, I can tell them it may take quite some time to recover, and you may not be thinking about having children now, but in the future you might, and you may not want to delay at that point. So it's very useful from that perspective. The data on the cardiac effects are reassuring in the sense that they didn't find any dramatic differences. The differences they found were within the normal range and of unclear physiologic consequence, and might have been related to compounds other than anabolic androgenic steroids. So I think those things are all very worthwhile in terms of the approach. Finally, this affirms that men who are taking anabolic androgenic steroids for longer than a year may take more than a year to fully recover. And so there is this relationship. Those men who are taking anabolic androgenic steroids for much shorter periods of time don't have suppression of their gonadal axis for more than usually 2 to 3, infrequently 6 months. So again, there's this time and possibly a dose relationship between anabolic androgenic steroids and suppression of the axis. So it's a very nice study from a really very fine investigative group that largely confirms previous findings.
Yeah, the only other thing I would add is, again, with counseling our patients, it's reassuring that they didn't see a lot of pronounced long-term issues in the past users, but the things they did see, as Brad mentioned, the smaller testis residual volume, the things they did see that did not reverse in the prior users, so testis volume and the gynecomastia and acne, you know, those are all things that may be clinically relevant to patients when we're counseling them. And I thought it was interesting that some of those effects that would maybe be the most significant to the patients didn't necessarily reverse.
Yeah, I think this information can be really powerful for us. A lot of it said things that we've thought before, but the more information we have on this, I think the more powerful it is. It gives us information that current use of androgens can have negative effects. And so as a motivation, just like Brad said, used in the right way, but to help motivate our patients to not abuse androgens. And then also to help them realize that, yes, you can recover from this, but don't wait long, because particularly for sperm production, it may be a prolonged period of recovery. And with this, we at least have some sense, just like Brad said, there's a lot of variability. The average has a lot of variation around that, but at least gives us a sense of when we counsel our patients what they should be looking for, and that this is something that they need to be stopping potentially years and years in advance of an interest in fertility in order to ensure that they would be able to have children. And with that, I would like to thank Imali Siracina and Brad Anawalt for joining us for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you, as our listeners, enjoyed and benefited from our conversation of this good article. And I hope that you will look for next month's edition to be released in mid-July.